Today's episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Are you happy because you win, or do you win because you're happy? At only 2.6 carbs and 95 calories, it's only worth it if you enjoy it. Stay tuned for the Ultra Player of the Week coming up later in the episode. All right, welcome on everyone. If you're listening on Locker Room, and of course, if you're listening after the fact on the pod, let's get rolling here. We got a lot to talk about. We're going to go through our annual playoff preview, which is a little bit more difficult than usual, but considering that we're not going to be recording between 11 p.m. Pacific time on Friday and noon Pacific time on Saturday, we're just going to have to go ahead and do it now. Those of you in Locker Room, feel free to get your speaker request in now. Of course, the way we're doing this, we're just going to record our normal show for about an hour, and then we'll get to some questions after that, but feel free to jump on in with the speaker request, and they will be handled in the order that they are received. You want to talk a little awards first here, though, John? You came out with your column. I did my pod about a week ago, so I think we're largely in agreement on most of these here. But MVP, you had Rudy Gobert second in MVP, pretty much higher than anyone else that I've seen.
I'm on my own island on this, without a question.
Well, I mean, that's you know, this is my thought on it, though. Well, here, why don't you explain why that is, and then we can talk about it.
Sure. From a value perspective, the team with the best record in the league built its entire system around him at both ends. And other than Jokic, he played far more minutes than any other MVP contender slash pretender, whatever. And I think he's really undervalued for, obviously he's going to win defensive player of the year, but I think he's actually undervalued for his offensive impact. And the suction he creates is what enables everything else Utah does offensively too. Now, obviously they have great shot makers and decision makers and whatnot, and that greases it quite a bit, but the whole, the center, the thing that's holding it all together is Gobert running around screening everyone and trucking to the rim every single time and just doing it over and over and over and over. And I think that's an easy thing to underrate, but he's really good at it. And combined with his massive defensive value, I thought he had a great MVP case this year that just kind of got swept under the rug.
Yeah, and you make a great point that he doesn't get enough credit for just his incredible intensity, his incredible effort level, and just what type of shape he's in. I mean, he's just in probably just about as good a shape as you're ever going to see from that type of a player. You know, KG type of shape, Bill Russell type of shape, like that, where he just runs constantly, as you mentioned, with the screens. He gets out on the floor. He's constantly moving. So I do think that's a really underrated aspect of his game. And I disagree with you in part because I think offense is just more important than defense, although probably more so even in the playoffs than in the regular season. And I do think that replacement level is generally higher, particularly at center defensively, than it is for someone like, say, Luka Doncic or Steph Curry or Jokic, obviously, as well, like those offensive initiators. Also, I think just the overall variance in defense was way down this year. Like being the number three or number four defense didn't put you as far above league average as it did in some years. But all that said, he absolutely makes their system run. You look at the on-off numbers, it's one of the greatest defensive on-off differentials that we've seen. And like there is a statistical case. Like if you look at all these one number metrics and on-off metrics, if you're going to say that defense is as important as offense, like you're not, this isn't crazy. Like I don't think that this is just like some massive outlier to say that in this regular season on this team that Rudy Gobert provided the most value, because there is a statistical case to support what you're saying.
Okay, so I'm not insane. On this small piece of turf anyway.
Yeah, there is something that you I can't remember what it was where you said that I wasn't insane, and that made me very happy. I'm going to present that in my case to the state when they come for me. But yeah, I mean, I had Gobert probably more in the 5 to 7 range, and you know, it is interesting. I think both of us obviously are kind of affected by just the tradition of what MVP has been for us, where for you, I mean, maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but there does seem to be at least an element to you of rewarding the best team, the most dominant team in the regular season, a little bit of kind of telling the story of the season as well, within reason, obviously. Is that fair to say, or is that a mischaracterization?
No, I think that's fair. I mean, I think part of his case is that Utah had the best record in the league, right? So I think without that, his case is definitely weaker. You know, if he had been in Curry's situation, dragging a flawed team to the eighth seed, I just don't think the case would have been as compelling. It would have been, you know, a Kevin Garnett year in Minnesota.
Yeah. Well, and he didn't miss any games. And that, to me, he and Jokic, to me, were really the only two candidates who almost survived this ridiculous season totally unscathed. So, yeah, I've, you know, in terms of this regular season, like, he easily is the best player in the Jazz, to be sure. So, let's see. So, here's another one that I thought was interesting. Jason Tatum, second team forward. Worth noting that you had Jimmy Butler and Paul George as guards. I think they're eligible both at guard and forward. That kind of messed everything up. When I do it, I just do it by the position that they've actually played this season and what I think they are. But Tatum, to me, I mean, like, I would be surprised if he makes All-NBA. He was not on any of my All-NBA teams. So what was the thinking behind having him on the All-NBA second team?
So I rewarded durability, basically. Like, he was just, I mean, he was there all year, and so many of these guys weren't.
Yeah.
So he just had such a massive minutes advantage on these other players. And I mean, I think he's getting a little too much of a deduction for Boston being viewed as a disappointment this year.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if that's totally fair. So that's where I came in with him as basically the other four guys I had on my second team, I think were pretty much slam dunk non-controversies, right? So, but when I compare Tatum to how many minutes Jimmy Butler or LeBron James or Paul George played, it's like, okay, like, there's a massive difference here. And I think he was better than Julius Randle, who would be the other one you could put there. So it came down to Tatum for me.
Yeah, and you had Chris Paul on your second team too. So it seems like you kind of skew more towards, like, would you say that your criteria for All-NBA are the same as for MVP?
I was a little softer on durability for All-NBA than I was for MVP, because I did feel like I put James Harden on the third team and LeBron James on the third team, because I was like, what the hell are you doing if these guys aren't on the top three teams? Now, Durant missed more than half the season, so I could leave him off more justifiably, I felt like.
Yeah.
That's where I got to with those guys. But yeah, I mean, especially at the top, you know, I still geared more toward value. You know, that's why I had Embiid on the second team. Because again, I mean, Gobert played 530 minutes more than he did. I mean, that's 11 full games out of 72. I mean, that's a lot of time. So it was hard for me to not recognize that.
Yeah, my thing was basically like, if you played more than half the games, you're eligible. So KD, no, but LeBron, yeah, and I would ding guys a little bit as a tiebreaker, but I also, again, this was such a crazy season. Now, I guess the other thing that I wanted to talk about is this. So let me paint a picture for you here. Here's a team that has been downtrodden in the Eastern Conference for a long time. They really made an unexpected improvement this year behind a young star. They got much better at the end of the floor that this young star contributes the most. He's the best player on his team, and he really powered his team to a top five seed in the Eastern Conference, way better than anyone expected them to be this season. So why isn't Trae Young getting a lot more love?
I saw that record scratch coming from a mile away that you're going to go Trae Young.
Why isn't he getting more love for All-NBA? I mean, he didn't even make the All-Star team for that matter. But it's so weird to me that people just don't appreciate how good this guy is. And, you know, someone like Julius Randle is basically the same story. Plays in New York, obviously. And Trae Young, they had plenty of injuries there. They were really good there. They started the year poorly, but they've been on this incredible tear lately. Like, why does he just get no respect? And maybe he gets more from you. I don't know. You didn't really talk about him too much in your piece, but
no, I didn't. I actually, like, statistically, he wasn't that overwhelming. A lot of guys had crazy numbers this year,
yeah.
And Young's relative to that were like, okay, yeah, you were pretty good. And I felt Atlanta's success was a little more of an ensemble cast thing. You know, Capella had a really good year. Gallinari, really good second half of the season. Bogdanovich, really good second half of the season. I thought actually once when they made the coaching change, but even more, like they got some of their players back too. I just thought they were a really good cast, and that was their biggest advantage. I mean, Trae Young was still their best player, but I thought their advantage was that their third and fourth best players were just way the hell better than yours.
Yeah, I think Trae Young was still the guy driving most of, and even when they were 14 and 20 to start the year, but basically a neutral point differential, that was basically all him. And a big reason why Lloyd Pierce got fired and that they were 14 and 20 was they just sucked when he was off the floor. I mean, they're for all year, basically, he had a massively positive differential. He's top 10 in basically all of the offensive impact metrics. I think there's a number of reasons. One is he just, you know, his game aesthetically, he's kind of gotten this reputation now as a foul drawer. The three-pointers have been lower than they were. He hasn't had like quite as many highlights. His individual efficiency is down a little bit and certainly is very reliant on free throw drawing. And probably a lot of voters just look at field goal percentage and three-point percentage and don't really consider true shooting that much, where he's still above league average. I think he's like 59%. But I just think that his... Yeah. Passing is just woefully underrated. Also, a guy who played a ton of minutes as well, that he just runs a lot of the things on that team run through him, particularly early in the year. And he just sets up a ton of open threes and is just statistically a top 10 offensive player in basketball. And then obviously the defense is another reason that he gets dinged. But that's sort of this easy way to this facile way to reject guys who aren't on winning teams. And that's fine. If you want to go that route, he's on a winning team. Like is they're very good when he's on the floor. Like they exceeded expectations. And so it's just very odd to me that he doesn't get the credit for it. Whereas someone like Julius Randle, who, you know, I think Trae Young is a much bigger part of the Hawks success than Randle is of the Knicks success, because the Knicks offense is not really that great. And you could say, hey, Randle is the guy pushing them to even be not that great as opposed to just atrocious. And he's got a lot of heavy lifting to do. But like the offense is the end of the floor where the Hawks are really awesome, where defense is for the Knicks. And I don't give Randle a bunch of credit for that. So it's just interesting to me that those guys kind of have similar stories. And yet Trae Young gets no love. And like Zach Lowe is writing that it would be reasonable to put Julius Randle on the All NBA first team this year.
Yeah, Zach's a friend of the show. No disrespect.
Yeah, no. I mean, obviously, you can disagree on things like that, which I do. But
it's interesting that he didn't get more traction in the second half of the season. I mean, I think what's definitely helping Julius Randle is that the Knicks are quote unquote a story this year, right?
Yeah.
And so guys always get extra credit for that. The guy in the surprise team, they always get a little bit of a bounce. So. I think that's definitely some of what happened with Julius Randle. I actually left him off because I couldn't put him at center. And I cheated because Jokic was listed as a forward. I'm like, okay, let me put Jokic and Gobert on the first team and Beat on the second team, so I don't have to put one of these guys as third team when they're clearly all among the 10 best players this year, in my opinion. But I couldn't take the way the ballot is set up then. So my third team center, instead of taking Randle or Zion Williamson, which is probably what you would do in real life, I had to take Bam Adebayo. And I couldn't take Anthony Davis because he just didn't play enough games.
So would you support making all NBA the same as all rookie, just no positions at all?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, me too. 100%. All right, let me see. I mean, I really had some issues with you putting Facundo Campazzo on your all rookie second team. You want to spend 10 minutes on that?
I mean, all rookie second team debates are very important. I think we should really extend this out.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a wonderful extension of who makes the rookie sophomore game. The Sprite Rising Stars. It's still
this,
Sprite, right?
This is me trying to qualify to be an assistant coach someday.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's, although how is that not sponsored by Mountain Dew, by the way, the Rising Stars? Like, it's so hip and cool. It should be Mountain Dew. It's Sprite. So, I mean, Sprite doesn't come.
You're going to get in trouble if we ever get a soda sponsorship for the show.
Sprite doesn't come in like a bright red color variation. How could it possibly be sponsoring the Rising like, Stars?
Why don't you just do Seagram's tonic water, right? Like, come on.
So all defense is another one that I thought was interesting, and I haven't done my all defense picks yet, but you had Caruso on there, you had Thybulle on there. I like Thybulle clearly to me, you know, is one of the better wing defenders in basketball. I got no arguments with you there. I just can't go there for all defense if it's not a guy who is playing 25 or 30 minutes a game every night and closing games.
Yeah, I get that. I understand that. And I wrestled with that, and I don't have a answer to that that I'm totally happy with right now. I thought Thybulle's stats were so overwhelming that he warranted an exception. And I really wasn't quite sold on any of the other guys I had on the second team, moving them up to the first team. And then I may have tried a little too hard to put a Laker on my team. Putting Caruso there, Davis missed time, LeBron missed. I could have put LeBron there too, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, so that's how I ended up with Caruso.
Yeah, and I think Caruso is good, and these guys have the decent statistical arguments. Yeah, and it's a little unfair to the concept of all defense to say, because the reason that those guys probably aren't out there is really more their offense at the end of games.
Yeah.
But that your offense still has to be good enough for you to have that defensive value where you're really the one who is who's getting stops at critical moments of the game.
I think there's an argument too with Caruso and a little bit with TJ McConnell, who's another guy I thought about, that they are able to play the way they play because they're playing 20 minutes and not 40 minutes.
Yeah.
Like Thybulle, the way he plays, I think he could do that for 40 minutes. I'm not sure Caruso could.
Yeah, well, TJ, he's been playing like 45 minutes a game in some of these games with Brogdon. has been out.
Yeah, the way the Pacers are dropping like flies, exactly.
Oh, man. Okay, so let's get to our playoff awards here. But first, John, I'm going to leave it up to you here. We just talked about a lot of players here, but which of those players is the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week?
Oh, it's got to be Rudy Gobert. Come on. We got to come up with something to honor the season he had, since he's apparently not going to win MVP or even really get a vote other than my imaginary one. So, yeah, Rudy Gobert, top-seeded Utah Jazz, played every game. Great season. So we tip our hat to Rudy Gobert.
Danny said this, and I agree. He should be the unanimous defensive player, which he's not going to be because people don't think about defense the way they think about Steph Curry in a 73 win season. But yeah, he should. I mean, there's just no argument for anyone else. And there's no argument for any beer other than Michelob Ultra either. It's only worth it if you enjoy it. 2.6 carbs, 95 calories. Enjoyment isn't the end game. It's the whole game. Rudy Gobert and the Jazz certainly enjoyed their games this season. Are the Jazz happy because they win, or do they win because they're happy? I think they're happy because they win, if I had to decide. In any event, Rudy Gobert is the Michelob Ultra Player of the Week, and we have succeeded in not being fired by David Locke for at least a few more weeks.
Yet. Yes.
I love being able to recommend products on this show that I use every day that I really appreciate. And nothing falls into that category more than Theragun. It's the handheld percussive therapy device that releases your deepest muscle tension using a scientifically calibrated combo of depth, speed, and power. I've tried a bunch of these other ones. There are a ton of knockoffs out there now. The off-brand stuff just isn't as good. It doesn't get that same level of depth. The material is not the same. It doesn't have that triangular handle that really lets you reach anywhere on your body that you might be feeling muscle tension. This isn't just like a surface level of massage. I think it actually works better than a massage to get rid of those adhesions, especially if you're old like me. You've got those little spots in your body that where you try to run, you try lift weights, you try to play your sport and you're just like, man, I've just got this knot here. Like this muscle is not firing the way I want it to. Theragun is the thing that's worked best for me to get rid of those adhesions, get my muscles feeling like they did when I was younger. And it's not just me who trusts it. Over 250 professional sports teams like Real Madrid and elite athletes like Paul George, DeAndre Hopkins, Maria Sharapova trust Theragun as well. You can try it for 30 days risk-free, starting at only $199. If you think these claims are ridiculous, I don't think they are. It's really has helped me that much. But if you think these claims are ridiculous, well, just give it a shot for 30 days. And if it doesn't live up to what you think it's going to be, you can return it risk-free. Go to Theragun.com/PER right now and get your Gen 4 Theragun today. That's Theragun.com/PER. Don't forget that /PER to let them know that you came from us. All right, let's talk some playoffs here. And
I'm pissed that the league copied our format. Because usually on Wednesday, we eliminate a team from the playoffs.
Poor Hornets, man. Lost six straight at the end. They may not have been ready for diet playoff basketball last night.
Yeah, man, that was rough. I mean, they were not prepared. And they lost to Washington the last game, but like they played a respectable game. Like I just didn't see this coming.
No, and I didn't know that Brogdon was going to play when I made my pick for the Hornets to be a slight favorite. Had I known that Brogdon was going to play and look as good as he did, which was encouraging for the Pacers, I probably would have favored the Pacers. So yeah, I mean, it was a disaster. Like starting Bismack Biyombo, this wasn't even autopilot either. I guess they just wanted him to match up at the start with Sabonis. But I mean, Cody Zeller handled him in the post just fine. Like I don't understand why they didn't just start Zeller.
And I was surprised they actually didn't throw more junk ball at them. They didn't really go to PJ Washington 5 much. And they were having trouble scoring pretty much the whole time. So yeah, it was just a weird game all around. And I mean, the one thing you can say in defense, it just went off the rails so quickly that you're kind of scrambling for the beginning if you're coaching in a game like that. And then like some of the stuff they were doing off the ball, like going, like trying to go under screens on pin downs from McDermott, and like they got beat multiple times on that. And I don't know, it was rough.
Yeah, LaMelo was absolutely awful.
A rough game.
Yeah, he had a couple of good games coming back from the wrist, but was not very good. I mean, they were within 12 at the end of the first, and then they gave up like 4 points in the last 20 seconds of the quarter, and then it really went off the rails at the start of the second.
First play of the second half, two guys run into each other and fall down. They get a dunk, and it's just like, all right, check please.
Yeah, that was when they're already down 24. So, Wizards and Pacers will play each other. But let's just talk generally about the playoffs as much as we can. Obviously, it's a little tougher not knowing right now whether Warriors or Lakers or other where they're gonna be in the bracket. So let's start though by just ranking the most interesting series to you here in the first round.
So for me, it's got to be Milwaukee Miami.
The league agrees. The league put that at the earliest possible time on Saturday, so they're right there with you.
Unfortunately, interesting to us doesn't always equate to eyeballs nationally. But I say that provisionally because I think if Phoenix plays the Lakers, that immediately moves to number one.
Well, whoever the Lakers play, I think would move to. I mean, you Jazz Lakers would be up there as well. Yeah, so that's probably number one. And Milwaukee Miami is number two. How did you feel, by the way, about, because we haven't talked in a couple of weeks here, about the Bucks' decision to smash Miami at home on Saturday to basically ensure that they would play Miami?
Yeah, that was really interesting, right? Because they could have potentially gotten themselves the Knicks instead. And it was, I mean, in a way, it was a positive thing by them, right? It was just saying, they were just saying, like, we don't care. We're not afraid. We want this. We owe them from last year. You know, let's bring it on. I don't think Miami is as good as they were last year. I think the Bucks will win this series, but I think they would have had an easier time winning a series against the Knicks, too.
Yeah, and the way I put it is you just want to maximize your chance of winning a championship, right? Like against the Knicks, if Giannis Antetokounmpo sprains his ankle in game two and can't come back until game five, they're probably still going to win the series anyway. That may not be the case against Miami. And then also, you're leaving Philly such an easy road to get into the East Finals now, and you're just creating more variance, right? Like, there's just no, you're making your overall road of winning a championship much harder,
right,
by doing it this way. And no, I understand that, and I'm sure Giannis, being the competitor that he is, was like, no, fuck it, like, let's beat these guys now, let's get some confidence. Jimmy Butler didn't play, which maybe made that a little bit different, but and then we're just gonna kick their ass again, like, fuck these guys, we're better than them, like, we're gonna show them. And I certainly understand that component of it, but that's why your organization, I mean it's crazy too, like, Mike Budenholzer, is they're talking about him maybe getting fired, and yet, you know, he's appeared to totally be on board with it. He said it doesn't make sense to try to manipulate things, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, the only argument I can see from his standpoint is if he's thinking, if I rest these guys, they won't have played a game for 10 days.
They could have just played against Chicago the next day, though.
Oh, they still have the Chicago game. You're right. Yeah, that's true.
I would feel
better. Yeah, there is that. I was thinking it was their last game of the season. It wasn't.
Yeah.
You're right.
Now, the other thing probably was they're thinking, hey, we could still get the 2 seed. We want to put pressure on the Nets. But they were playing the Cleveland Cavaliers, who had some slight incentives to lose basketball games. Had
some incentives pointing in a little different direction. Yeah. There was also a potential scenario with home court advantage in a finals against the Clippers or Denver. I can't reconstruct that in my head, and
the Clippers did not seem too concerned about getting home court advantage against the Bucks, though. I can assure you of that. Have you ever seen anything like that game?
Man, that was rough. I mean, the level of degaff in the last 90 seconds of that game for an allegedly close game was pretty amazing.
Well, I thought actually, given the personnel that was on the floor, that the Thunder were at least trying. And hey, you know what? If I'm Alexei Pokuševski, I don't want the Thunder getting Cade Cunningham. I want to be the starting small forward next year.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Not that he was even probably thinking about that, but I mean, Ty Lue, the 8 post-ups, punch 5.
the ISOs for Daniel Oturu. And then, good shot, Poku. Let's just dribble out the clock now and hand the ball to the ref. Like, that was pretty bad.
No, it was pretty incredible. I mean, I think that at least with teams that, you know, because we've seen games like this before where, you know, it's two teams really, you know, fighting for lottery position, and particularly under the old system as well, when it mattered even more, you know, two teams that are like right at the bottom of the lottery fighting for position. But at least, like, I don't think the coaches were in on it. Maybe Rick Carlisle in some of those Mavs years, because he was just so established. But Ty Lue, holy shit, was he in on it. Like, it was the greatest tanking coaching performance I've ever seen in my life.
Maybe we should have made him the Michelob Player of the Week. Here's my question for the Clippers. Why?
What do you mean, why? They avoid the Lakers until the conference finals. That's the only team they're scared of. It's obvious to me, I think. Is that
okay?
I mean, the first tank against Houston prevented them from playing the Lakers in the first round. Those 97 analytics guys there cranked out that, hey, if we lose this game, Denver and Portland playing each other means that there's no way we can face the Lakers in the first round. And then you get to the 4 seed. They're not scared of the Mavs either. That's what you were thinking, right? That they would rather have played Portland.
I'm thinking that. And then I'm thinking, are you sure the Lakers are going to be 7? Like, you're putting a lot of equity here, right, on the Lakers beating Golden State tonight.
Yeah. I think they also really like their matchup against the Jazz as well. I think that was part of it. I think that they like how it looks with Marcus Morris at center going against Rudy Gobert. I think that's looked pretty good for them. So, I think they didn't really want to be on the same side of the bracket as the Nuggets either. Frankly, Jokic is a really difficult matchup for them to deal with. So I would have done the same thing, I think, in their in their view. And you know, probably the other thing you can say is, all right, if the Lakers can't beat the Warriors tonight, are they then going to go ahead and beat the Jazz in the first round as well? And I mean, the Lakers are pretty substantial favorites tonight, I would say. So
do you feel as though you've exhausted basically all that digital media has to offer at this point? Do you feel like you want to just be doing something better with your time? I highly recommend giving Masterclass a shot. My wife has gotten really into cooking at home lately, and I was like, yeah, why don't you do one of these awesome Masterclass cooking classes here? They just have unbelievable stuff for cooking basically anything that you want to. They just added Aaron Franklin, Franklin's Barbecue in Austin, best brisket around, teaching Texas style barbecue cooking. Massimo Bottura teaches modern Italian cooking. That was my attempt at an Italian accent to pronounce it properly. I don't know how well I did. Alice Waters, right here where I live in Berkeley, California, teaching the art of home cooking, basically invented the farm to table movement. Thomas Keller, Wolfgang Puck, Nikki Nakayama, teaching modern Japanese cooking. And obviously, it's not just cooking and food. There's Phil Ivey teaching poker, Serena Williams on tennis, Steph Curry shooting and ball handling. The way to get started with them is at masterclass.com/PER. Easy to remember that /PER because that's the statistic that John invented. You can get unlimited access to every masterclass and 15% off an annual membership. That's at masterclass.com/PER. One more time, masterclass.com/PER for 15% off masterclass. Don't forget that /PR to let them know that you came from us. Say you had a mess in your home, a rather disgusting substance, perhaps. You might want to use some water to clean that. You wouldn't just use a dry piece of toilet paper. Well, that probably should apply to your body as well. And that's why you should try out a bidet. And Hello Tushy's brand new 3.0 modern bidet attachment is here to get your butt absolutely pristine. It's super easy to install. It's way more affordable than other bidets. You just attach it to your existing toilet. There's no electricity or extra plumbing needed. And it also cuts your toilet paper use by 80%. So it pays for itself in just a few months. If you never tried this before, you want to give it a shot. 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. So you don't have to worry if it's not for you. I highly recommend that you try it. The way to get started with them, hellotushy.com/PER. That will get you 10% off plus free shipping. Go to hellotushy.com/PER for 10% off. hellotushy.com/PER. Don't forget that /PER to let them know that you came from us.
Okay, let's get back to the playoffs here.
Okay.
Oh yeah, this is great. Actually, I have this note in here from last year. Least interesting series, non-Brooklyn Orlando division, because all of those teams were in the bubble.
The least interesting series will be the series with Philadelphia in it.
Yes.
I think they're going to mash either Boston or Washington. Either Washington or Indiana. Indiana in particular has basically no bigs right now except Sabonis, so that could get ugly pretty fast.
Yeah, I don't like Goga Bitadze's chances in the post to guarding Embiid. That could be a little bit of a problem.
It's going to be more like a no-go guy.
Noga Bitadze.
Noga.
He's actually been okay this year. I still like him. All right, but yeah, I think that's.
I like him long term, but yeah, he's roadkill against Embiid.
Yeah, and outside of the 1-8, Clippers Dallas is not titillating me that much.
You know, Dallas did beat them by 51 points.
Yeah, Kawhi didn't play in that game, but
apparently none of the other Clippers did either.
Yeah, so. Yeah, I don't know. They kind of had the Clippers in trouble last year before Porzingis got hurt. But I just think the Clippers are better and Dallas is worse this year, particularly Porzingis. I don't know that he can play at the level that he played at last year. And the Clippers aren't going to be playing Montrezl Harrell, who is Luka Doncic's personal punching bag in that first round last year before he became Nikola Jokic's personal punching bag in the second round. Yeah. You know, that just seems like a pretty easy five gamer, maybe six, but the Clippers don't really end up getting into difficulty.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, yeah, for a 4-5 series, it doesn't feel very competitive, you know, as opposed to Knicks Atlanta. I mean, check this out. The Knicks in Atlanta not only had the same record this year, they were 1 point away from having the exact same point differential.
Whoa, wow. That's exciting stuff.
Yeah.
Who do you like in that series, by the way?
I like Atlanta. even though New York won all three meetings. I thought New York had to shoot outlier well to win those three games. I think Atlanta right now, in terms of who they will have available in these games, just has a little bit more talent to put on the floor. Neither of these coaches has coated themselves in glory in the postseason. So it'll be interesting to watch from that perspective. But yeah, I like the Hawks.
Yeah, I think I'm probably going to pick that Hawks in six. And I have concerns about Trae Young in the playoffs as much as I like him as a regular season player. But I don't think that the Knicks really, they don't play different defensive styles. They're not going to switch really, you know, they're going to keep a big back. Like, I think Trae, and he's actually, although the Knicks swept the season series, Trae Young was like plus 20. And they were going to win the last game against them until Trae sprained his ankle. So yeah, I think I like the Hawks also in that. And you know, I want to see whether Tibbs is capable of really adjusting defensively to deal with the shooting that the Hawks have.
That's what I wonder too. If they're just gonna give away too many deep threes that Trey and Bogdanovich and Herter and Hunter's back now. Hunter played 24 minutes in the final game of the season. I think he gives them a big lift if he's able to do that in the postseason.
Guarding Julius Randle, I think, is going to be a problem. Like, he's torched John Collins pretty badly this year.
I think they have to put Capella on him.
Yeah, I could see them doing that in the last 5 minutes of games when Randle really goes into his ISO thing. I would like to see, the Knicks, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think they've done much this year of having Randle handle the ball and attacking Trae Young in pick and roll. I think that could be really effective for them, but I haven't seen them do a ton of that. But I'm really interested in this series just because we haven't seen really any of these teams and players in the playoffs before. You know, this is two, because normally you'd say, okay, you know, you'll get these series where it's a playoff ingenue matching up with a team that's been there before and you know what that team is, and one team is going to really struggle just because they're not ready for playoff basketball and they're not that good. But, and you know, if either of these teams were going against a team with playoff experience that was really good, I would pick them to lose pretty easily. But going against each other, it's going to be fascinating, even if it's not going to be the absolute highest level of basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it'll give us some clues about these teams, about what they need to do for the offseason to really try to move up. Because, I mean, either of these teams will be a massive underdog in the second round against Philadelphia, right? So
yeah,
it's really more about, what does this signify about where these teams stand in the bigger picture?
The star player who has the toughest matchup in the first round.
I mean, can we say Giannis going against Bam again?
Yeah, I mean, he did not have a great series against Miami last year until he was killing them in game four, and then he sprained his ankle. That's a pretty well, and it's not even necessarily Bam either. Like, they last year they put Crowder on him a lot. They had Butler on him a little bit. They put Bam out there as well. You know, we'll see how Ariza matches up with him. He doesn't quite have the same strength. He's got some good old man strength, but he's not quite the bowling ball that Jay Crowder is. I think that's a good one. He has not particularly succeeded in that before, but the Bucks have more options now than they did last year also.
The other one, it's not going to matter, but James Harden being guarded by Marcus Smart.
Yeah, if that's what it is. I mean, I think the Celtics will probably just have to do a lot of switching. I am really curious what the defensive philosophy is going to be for the Celtics in that series. Are they going to try and go more Grant Williams at center and do more switching? Like, I'm guessing that Robert Williams isn't really going to be able to contribute after re-aggravating the turf toe. And so the Unicornet, that's not exactly the guy.
The Unicornet. No, it's the Green Cornet.
No, I think the Unicornet is better because he like kind of plays like Kristaps Porzingis. Like, he's slow, he protects the rim, and he shoots threes.
He kind of plays like Kristaps Porzingis.
And he was on the Knicks for a while too. Like, that's where he came up. So he was like the replacement.
I kind of sing like Michael Stipe. Like, we're both bald white dudes.
And you're in Georgia too. It's really.
And I'm in Georgia. Yeah.
Yeah. You spent a lot of time in Athens scouting Anthony Edwards last year.
Oh goodness.
Oh yeah, let's
I do think this is a Grant Williams at five series for Boston. Yeah. I agree with that.
Although I mean he hasn't really been playing much either. So like I mean I think they're gonna try it just because basically nothing that they try is gonna work. So they're gonna try other things and then that's not gonna work either. But he'll be one of the things that they cycle through as well. Let's see, who else has a tough matchup here. And Sabonis going against Embiid, that if that's what it is, that'll be pretty difficult as well. Or Russell Westbrook going against Embiid and Ben Simmons. I mean, that's going to be really rough.
Yeah. Westbrook against Simmons. Yeah, that would definitely be a tough one. Beal against Tybull and Danny Green, and then Embiid at the rim. I mean, what Washington's going to have some issues trying to score against that Philly team, I think. What about DeAndre Ayton against Anthony Davis?
Yeah, if that's what it is. Yeah, if it is, it still remains to be seen how much they play AD at center. Although Marc Gasol is certainly not exactly an easy guy to post up for Ayton either. But yeah, I mean, that'll be a fascinating series if it does. I mean, whoever the Lakers play, it's going to be absolutely fascinating. Whoever the Warriors play, if they make it, it is going to be absolutely fascinating as well, I think. Who would you say is the star player is the easiest matchup?
Star player with the easiest matchup.
Is it Dame Lillard?
Kawhi and Paul George? Well, who are they even going to put on Lillard? Is it going to be Dozier? Is it going to be Campazzo?
Yeah, I mean, I don't even know if Dozier is going to be able to play. I don't even know if Will Barton is going to be able to play. But obviously, you know, going against Jokic is either rim protection or being a little slower, getting out on the floor. I mean, now Dame Lillard, he himself may not be able to score that much. If they put two on the ball, he'll have to get off the ball. But I think finally Portland has the horses to attack that strategy. Norman Powell, like if he gets the ball, he's just putting his head down and going to the rim, and there's not really going to be much there to stop him, I don't think.
That's an interesting series, that Denver-Portland. You know, the Blazers looked so morose for most of this season, and then they really turned it on these last 10 games or so. And Denver's in kind of the opposite situation where they look like a real title contender, and then Murray goes down. They start losing other players. Like, we don't even really know who's suiting up for them in this series, I think, other than the MVP, right? And Michael Porter, and maybe that's enough, just having those two. But that feels like a 7-game series again.
No, it does. I picked it yesterday as Portland in seven, a reprise of 2019. But
wow,
yeah, I mean, Jokic obviously is going to have a pretty decent matchup too. Like Nurkic is probably better than your average center defending him, but the rest of Portland's defense is relatively porous. I think the only problem for Jokic is Denver is just not having a ton of shooting. So maybe in a playoff situation, you'd be able to double more intelligently and just force some of these guards for Denver to make plays and make shots.
Yeah, I mean, and that seems like a similar playbook to what happened, was it 2 years ago? And you have Porter there now, who's obviously a knockdown shooter, but you don't have Murray anymore, and it's just so questionable in that backcourt with the shot making.
Yeah. Now, I think one big difference is that Jokic is so much more aggressive as a jump shooter now than he was back in 2019, and that can really open up that Blazers defense that relies on keeping a big center close to the rim. Best coaching matchup. And can we say Steve Kerr against Frank Vogel in this game tonight? I mean, it's only one game.
You're right. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one.
That's going to be
I like that.
Very interesting. Or Draymond Green versus LeBron James.
Yeah, for real.
That's
good. You know, Budenholzer versus Spoelstra again is going to be really interesting. Because of what happened last year and because it'll be Budenholzer's final series.
Oh, John, you're getting ahead to biggest coaching mismatch. That's a separate category.
Uh-oh. Yes. Well played. I want to see what Monty Williams can do in the postseason. He's going to end up with a tough matchup either way. I mean, for a team that had the second best record in the league, I mean, Phoenix kind of got the short end of the stick here. you know, the likely facing the Lakers. I think whoever wins that series wins the second round too and makes it to the conference finals. But still, you know, Monty Williams is going to be challenged right away, I think. So that's a really interesting second round series if it's Suns Lakers.
Yeah. Monty has really only had two postseason series. One of them, he coached Chris Paul against the Lakers in 2011. And they actually took the Lakers a little bit longer than expected in that series. And then he got swept by the Warriors in 2015 and was summarily dismissed after that. The Bud versus Miami thing, I mean, that's going to be fascinating because they are going to need some kind of a different plan, right? And they've supposedly been doing all this experimentation all year. The one thing though that worries me is I don't think they've actually looked that good, the Bucks, defensively, while they've been doing the experimentation. Like, I see a lot of miscommunications. Right. You kind of don't know what they're in a lot of times watching. That's always a problem for a coach when you're watching the game and you're like, I can't tell you what the defense is and what, like, I can't tell you who screwed up, you know, like, because I don't even know what you're supposed to be in.
It makes them unscoutable, though.
I'm sorry?
It makes them unscoutable.
I'm still picking.
That was always my argument about the, the Josh Smith era Hawks, especially before they got good. And it was just like a bunch of 20-year-olds running around. It's like, well, you can't scout their ATOs because they're just going to do whatever once the ref hands the inbound or the ball. So,
yeah, the back in the days of the draft of the Joshes, was that 2005?
Yes.
Josh Smith and
and Childress.
Maybe that was 2004, actually. Jeez. That would probably have to be it, Spo versus Bud. I mean, just because we've seen it before, and we'll see whether that changes or not.
What about Stotts versus Malone?
Well, Stotts won a series against Malone and arguably outcoached him 2 years ago.
Another guy who might need to win the series to keep his job.
Yeah, actually, Terry Stotts. Yeah, I mean, can you imagine if Portland wins this series against a hobbled Denver team, and then they just like double down again on this team, like the same fool's gold that caused them to double down in 2019? They just do it again.
That's totally
Neil O'Shea comes
too
out in the media of like, oh, we're a championship contender next year.
Yeah.
They signed Norman Powell to $25 million a year after this. The series that has the most variables.
Series with the most variables.
I've got one. Milwaukee and Miami, to me.
Okay.
Just because Miami is just such a massive variable, right? I mean, they sucked all year. They started playing a lot better. Jimmy Butler, this is... Havershaw had this stat. Jimmy Butler only played in one of their 12 games, or maybe it was 9 games, whatever, against the
top three in the East.
Right.
Yeah.
And they won that game against Philly. They killed him. And so just the Miami shooting. I mean, also, like, both those teams bomb a bunch of threes. So just the three-point shooting variance. I don't know, you know, Milwaukee, how well are they going to play different defensive schemes? I picked that as Bucks in six, but Miami easily could win that series, I think. Or they could get swept. Like I could see Miami winning that series and getting swept very easily. Their entire existence since the beginning of last season has been a study in variance.
Right. I see a lot of variables in the Atlanta-New York series. Sure. Just because I think we don't know exactly what either of those teams are. We don't know how much was the Knicks giant shooting progression this year? Like, is that real?
Yeah, overtime.
Do we know that? Yeah. And not just Randall either. I mean, Barrett and Bullock and there's one other guy too. Derrick Rose had a massive jump.
Yeah.
And what are these coaches in the postseason? Or are they what they thought we were, to paraphrase Dennis Green? And is that going to raise its ugly head? First real series for most of these guys too. First time we've seen them in this spotlight. I mean, who in this series has even played in the playoffs before? Derrick Rose?
Yeah, Gallo.
I think Reggie Bullock. Bullock got swept in a first round once, right? Yeah, Gallo would be the other one, right? Capella played in Houston.
Yeah, he's probably he's the most experienced guy. Well, he and Gallo are probably the most experienced guys in the Hawks. But Bogdan, he's been in purgatory this whole time. He's got a lot of FIBA experience, obviously. Well, and I've got another one too, which is the health of LeBron James in whatever series. That is the biggest variable in the entire playoffs. with that high ankle sprain and the ability to re-injure it. I mean, my working assumption has been that I think he'll play kind of at a reduced level the way that Steph Curry did when he came back from his MCL injury in 2016. You know, that he'll still be the same guy, but that it'll be a little bit less effective as well. I think actually one of the things I was saying yesterday to Danny was it makes more sense to go small now because he can play out of the post more. He's not as reliant on attacking the basket and attacking off of 1 foot and exploding. Where if you play out of the post, it's kind of easier. You're more stable. You're playing off of 2 feet mostly. You're less likely to re-injure it. So I would be trying to go more with him in the post, I think, if I were them. But then, of course, their three centers probably can't play if they're going to play that way.
Yeah, yeah. Which, I mean, that could be seen as a feature and not a bug. But the other thing is, don't sleep on AD's shoulder either, right? I mean, that thing's not 100% either. There's just some questions all around physically with this Laker team.
You do see him like grabbing down at that calf every once in a while as well, where he had the tendinosis. That can actually take us into rotation players who are most likely to have their roles cut. And I mean, the Lakers centers have got to be at the top of that.
Absolutely. Yep. Yep. The other guy, I was actually thinking of another center for tonight. I don't know if we're going to see much of Brandon Clark.
Oh, against
it just Antonio. Seems to me like Memphis could just cut it to Valanciunas, Tillman, and Jaren and leave it at that. You know, cut it down to eight. Basically,
what are you talking about? Memphis and San Antonio, they're playing. That's part of the playoffs.
What? They're playing in a real game that they like counts and stuff. Yeah.
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 I was just going to tune in for
it's on TV playing. And everything. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, not many people will know that it's on TV, perhaps. I actually think San Antonio has a decent chance of winning that game. I actually think they match up reasonably well with Memphis, just with Pirtle's rim protection. I know you picked Memphis. I picked Memphis to win too, but I think San Antonio probably has more of a chance than people are
going. They have a reasonable shot at winning that game. I would be more inclined to pick them if Derek White was still available. Sure. But it's interesting, you know, they're kind of similar in some ways. Like they don't really, you know, they both rely so heavily on paint points and, transitions, and the half court offense is a little clunky for both of them. And they like to play big. Like it's kind of interesting how they're similar while being different.
MVP of the first round, who do you think it'll be? And we probably need to limit this to series that are somewhat competitive, at least. Like Joel Embiid is gonna just destroy whoever he plays in the first round, but in like real series,
it's gonna be either Lillard or Jokic, right? I mean, they're both gonna put up monster stats in that series, I would think.
That would be my expectation. But you could, I mean, there are a lot of guys who could emerge, right? Like if Utah beats the Warriors or beats the Lakers, you know, it could be Rudy Gobert. It could be LeBron if the Lakers beat Phoenix, for example. You know, there are a lot of teams that could emerge. Could be Kawhi in the, I mean, if Dallas is competitive, I mean, it's going to have to be with Luka being so unbelievable.
Luka, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
Julius Randle will be another one.
Yeah, no, or maybe Trae Young.
or Trae Young, yeah.
Any rookies that you think are just kind of interesting to watch in these playoffs? This will be our close to our last one here, and then we can move into the speaker request in about 5 minutes here. So thanks to everyone who got yours in. We will try to get to as many of those as we can.
Over under on the number of minutes Obi Toppin is playing against Onyeka Okongwu.
Oh man!
During competitive portions of the game,
yeah,
I'll set the over under at 3 a night.
Well, I think that might just be for Toppin's minutes alone. Randall played 45 minutes in one of these games when the Knicks were scraping by against some pretty inferior.
Yeah,
was that against? That might have been like the Celtics game where the Celtics didn't even play in their guys and they barely beat them.
Yeah, I think you might be right.
Yeah, so I mean, Facundo Campazzo is going to be not that much of a rookie and a very experienced guy, but I think he's someone who has some defined weaknesses, and over the course of a 7-game series, I think could start to get exploited some.
Absolutely, yeah.
He's an interesting one. Emmanuel,
I don't know how much Quickly plays.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rookies we're going to see the most are actually tonight. It's going to be Xavier Tillman and Desmond Bain. I think those are the two rookies you're going to see the most.
Yeah, they only played Tillman like 2 minutes. And I think a lot of people prefer seeing Tillman rather than the Jaren at center minutes, which haven't looked very good for the Grizz since he came back. It's tough for the Grizz reintegrating him. He has not been the same guy quite yet. But obviously, given where you want to go as a franchise, he needs to play. I think Quickley is a big one going back to him, because whether Tibbs and how much Tibbs plays Elfrid Payton and how much they're punting on that first unit where they just have no spacing going up against playoff scouting, I think Quickley to me makes the most sense to move into that starting lineup rather than
that's Rose. The game, the adjustment after the first game they lose, right?
Yeah. Well, as we saw, hopefully people will learn in the play-in game in the future that, you can't treat it like game one of a playoff series, which is what I think like Scott Brooks and James Borrego did starting Biombo and Alex Len last night. And you could also just try to win game one with your best group. That's what Spo did last year, right? That was such an underrated thing where they started Myers, Leonard, or Olynyk all year, and they start the first game of the playoffs.
Just game one, yeah.
And it's just
They didn't wait till they were down 2-0 to be like, okay, let's change stuff up. Yeah, it was just like, no, we'll make the adjustment right now at the beginning of the series. Yeah. I thought that was great.
Because these coaches know, even the bad coaches, they know who their best guys are, because we see that, it didn't go well. I'm going to not play Bismack Biyombo the entire rest of the game after starting him, right? What your best lineup is. Just start your best lineup. It's the playoffs. Try to win. You're not Steve Kerr with the 2017 Warriors. You need to actually put your best foot forward the entire game to win and get your team, especially for a young team to, they're down 7 before Biyombo even goes out of the game. All right, sorry. Let's
he's smacking his mic. He's so upset about this.
And I mean, the most interesting coach, obviously, I think it's Budenholzer pretty clearly here. That's just and there's discussion, obviously, that he needs to make a significant advancement. I mean, basically, it seems like what the standard is going to be in Milwaukee, according to Sam Amick's reporting, is just that they need to basically give hope with this performance this year that a championship is realistically in their future with Mike Budenholzer as coach.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. And man, they got a tough pathway, man. Potentially going Miami, Brooklyn, Philadelphia, and then West Champ.
That's going to be one of the hardest paths that anyone has ever had. And the Lakers' path maybe could be. If they actually get the 7, it probably won't actually be as bad as they would have thought, other than just the fact that they're going to be on the road for all 3 series.
Yeah, because that 3-6, if the Clippers had tried in that final game, then it looks much more difficult for the Lakers, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the Clippers also wanted to have what they perceived to be the easiest path. Okay, 2 more categories here before we take questions. The best playoff defense is...
Is it the Lakers still?
I think so.
Can we still say that?
Because they have all the rim protection, but they also have the ability to go small. They can play any style, right? Whereas Philly and Utah would probably be your other 2 candidates, and Milwaukee would probably be your other 3 candidates. And I just don't trust those teams to be versatile and execute different styles the way you do with Hill. And I think that Anthony Davis is the best playoff defensive player right now.
The Clippers have that variability, but they don't have that interior guy who's at that level.
Yeah, they can switch, but once you get past the first guy, they have no help defense beyond that.
Right.
Yeah, they don't have that Draymond or that AD on the back line. And best playoff offense, I think we can just say it's the Nets and take some questions here.
I think we can, leave that one there. Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
If you're hiring for your company, what you need is help making your short list of quality candidates. You don't need 500 candidates who just applied with no regard for what the actual qualifications are. You need Indeed instead. You can post, screen, and interview all on Indeed. You can also use skill tests to winnow down the field of applicants. And using Indeed overall will, on average, reduce the amount of time you spend on hiring by 27%. You only pay for the candidates that meet your must-have qualifications, and you can schedule and complete video interviews in your Indeed dashboard. They've got over 130 skills tests, or you can even add your own. According to Talent Nest, Indeed delivers 4
4 times more hires than all other job sites combined. So you're getting the high quality candidates, you're saving time, and ultimately getting the applicants that are right for you. Get started right now with a free $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/locked, the name of this network. Get a $75 credit at Indeed.com/locked. Indeed.com/locked. Offer valid through June 30th. Terms and conditions apply.
So let's get in here and first guy, hopefully he's still here, friend of Dunked On, Christian Pelletier. You are on. Christian, what's going on, man? How are you? We'll take a second to let him jump in. Christian, you're muted. Now John is gone.
No, John is gone. But yeah, my question. Yeah. Yeah, thanks for having me on, and actually, I have two questions for John if he ever jumps on.
Yeah, let me see if I can get him back in here. 1 second.
All right.
Maybe his internet went down. See if he's still there on our podcast recording. Yeah, he's still there. Then all right, we'll try and get him back in. But yeah, what are the questions for him?
For John, when looking at coaching hirings, obviously, you know, favorite schemes are important, but how closely do teams look at not only kind of what the coach tends to run with his teams, but how his teams execute generally? For example, like the Bulls perimeter guys definitely set a new record this season in terms of number of times that they were hit by opposition ball screens, whereas Thibodeau's teams, for example, always do a really good job of increasing ball pressure just when the screen is about to arrive and avoid getting hit. And maybe an offensive example, for years, bigs have been taught, especially against drop coverage, is to hit and hold their ball screens. But with Denver under Mike Malone, especially with Jokic and also even with Mason Plumlee last year, the bigs are taught only to hold the screens if the on-ball defender's feet are parallel to the three-point line. If his feet are directing the offensive player towards the screen, there really isn't a reason to hit your screen, but rather it's better to slip since the ball handler is already getting into the paint. How much like is stuff like that looked at when thinking about coaching hirings?
Yeah, so John, this is Christian. He's a coach in Finland, also does some NBA broadcasting in Finland. But his question was, how much do coaches look at just how well the players execute, or I'm sorry, how much do front offices look at how well coaches' players execute the scheme in terms of just like some of the little stuff as opposed to just what the overall scheme is when you're evaluating a coaching hire or fire or whatever?
Yeah, I think that kind of runs hand in hand because they have to be able to explain the scheme and get the players to execute it. I mean, that's the whole thing, right? And you have to be able to do things that are within your players' skill sets, both physically and mentally. So, you know, and in some ways that confers an advantage. Like Nick Nurse 2 years ago had all these crazy high IQ guys, so he could throw a lot of random out there and they would figure it out. But so we took advantage of that. But then you got to know if you have a different kind of team that you have to keep it simpler. Like that was like the original advantage of Scott Brooks. Like we dump on Scott Brooks, but in Oklahoma City was that team was so young and he did keep it simple and it really helped them because he kept it simple.
Excellent. And secondly, around 20, I counted at one point of the 30 starting centers this season were players of a foreign origin. Also, out of the top rebounders in this year, only Russell Westbrook was the only American in the top 11. What's the discussion around the league, or is there a worry generally that the AAU system is really failing in developing bigs? Like, for example, if you're picking between two bigs in the second round or something, is it safer taking a European big in those situations?
I don't think that's been a big discussion. I mean, I do think overseas they do a better job of developing the skill level of their bigs as opposed to just having to be rim runner shot blockers. So I think there's something to that. Beyond that, I mean, I don't think it's something we discuss a whole bunch. Because honestly, I mean, there have been sort of what you would call unskilled overseas bigs that have been drafted and, sure, and thrived as well. You know, you look at Clint Capella or Rudy Gobert, for instance. So that's interesting. I think there's something going on there, but I'm not sure it's something that like front offices really actively talk about either.
So here's my theory.
All right, appreciate you guys.
Yeah, here's my theory on that, Christian, is just that being a big man, a lot of it is just about your physical characteristics. And so people are going to emerge with those physical characteristics basically anywhere in the world. And so Gobert, Capella, I think are two pretty good examples of that, where they're not the highest skill players, but they just, because being a big man is more dependent on just what your physical skills are, whereas, you know, here in the US, like guards, wings, like those are guys who are kind of more dependent on like having a high skill level and also creativity. So I actually think that for guards and wings, I would say that the US does a better job of developing those guys. We also probably have generally more athletic prospects, but guys who just grow up playing in a more creative, more one-on-one environment. At least when I've talked to some Europeans about that years ago when I was at the Eurocamp, they sort of, they wish that there was a little bit more individual creativity allowed in European development. But once you get to bigs, you can be big and you can be strong and you can jump and grow up anywhere. Whereas getting that creativity at a young age that really gets your, not that you can't develop that overseas, but I think more American players have that. But that's an interesting thought. I mean, now, you know, Karl Anthony Towns and Joel Embiid, I mean, those guys are basically products of the American development system. So some of those guys are technically international players, but they were still developed here. So, but I mean, I think there are reasons why you do see most of the, I mean, another reason too, frankly, is just that, hey, if a guy's 7 foot, no matter where he comes from, like you're going to get scouts' attention. Whereas as a guard, maybe you're not going to, right? Like someone like Campazzo or, Milos Teodosic, right? Like those guys, you got to really prove it overseas before people will believe in you, unless you're like a really athletic guy. Thanks for that, Christian. And we got to talk about your Mike Malone email that you sent me at some point. Christian thought we had Mike Malone way too low in our coach rankings. You're not alone in that. All right, but let's get to Drew here. Drew, you are on with me and John. How you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for taking the question. I'm going to steer us off the playoffs for a second. I got a two-parter. The first is for you, Nate, which is you mentioned in the Dunked On podcast this week that you heard a little bit about behind the scenes stuff about Zion not wanting to be in New Orleans. I know you mentioned some outside stuff where we can all read the tea leaves, but I'm curious what that behind the scenes bit is. And then the second part is, I'm wondering if you guys have heard of any creative solutions that you think do have promise to prevent guys from teaming up midway through their careers, whether it's, I don't know, sometimes I've wondered about the possibility of, you know, there being ways for a team that's drafted a player to pay them far more than the normal max, but maybe off the cap or something like that. I wonder if there are any creative solutions that you do believe in.
Well, so actually, I wanted to get John's thoughts on this. I've talked about this Zion situation pretty extensively, like David Griffin's comments about it, Zion's broken finger and all that stuff. Like, John, what is your take on what's going on in New Orleans right now? Like, have you heard anything about like Zion not really being that unhappy? Or not being that happy there? Or
there is so much smoke that there cannot possibly not be a fire.
Yeah, that's kind of the position I took.
That is what I will say on that front. And you know, I don't want to get into specifics quite yet, because you know, we work for a news organization and we, you know, try to get all the sourcing and everything. But yeah, that is definitely a thing that is making the rounds.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say this, like, you know, if we're talking about something that wouldn't qualify as hearsay in a court of law, you know, have I had conversations with like, oh yeah, someone in the organization who says, oh yeah, he's miserable there, or like someone in his camp? No, like it's kind of secondhand stuff. But generally, the track record of things like this, when you hear it from a ton of people, and there's all this other, see, that's the other thing too, right? Like if there was nothing else publicly that we knew to back this up, and you hear something like this, like then it's easy to dismiss it, right? But like when all of the arrows are pointing in a certain direction, including some things that you hear second or third hand behind the scenes, that's, it's pretty easy, I think, to draw the conclusion there is what I'd say. And Drew, I think we're just going to leave that second question for me for another time, because we do want to get a few more people in there. That's probably going to take us like 10 minutes to talk about that. So I apologize, we're not going to get to that one, but let's bring in Caleb. Caleb, you are on with John and me. You are unmuted. Let's go.
Hi there. I've listened for a long time, and I'm a big Raptors fan, and I just wanted to get you guys' thoughts on the whole Kyle Lowry situation. Just everything from the trade not happening and him taking a lot of rest at the end of the season and his potential contract in the upcoming summer. Just your guys' thoughts on what you think about all that, and then what are the chances that the Raptors actually get him back for next season?
Yeah, for those who missed quickly, let me just give a little summary. Yesterday,
sure. He
had his exit interviews, and he basically said, I'd love to be back, and like I did want to try to do something special this year. It didn't work out, but years and money talk was his quote. So now, John, if you want to weigh in there, now that people have that background.
I was a bit surprised that they didn't deal him because I didn't see how bringing him back made a ton of sense next year. And the only way that I think it does is if it's like a Marcus Morris type thing where they sign him to a 1-year deal and then try to shop him again at midseason. Because, they're going to be rebuilding around these younger guys like they are. And by the next time they're good enough to win a championship, Kyle Lowry is not going to be an important part of that. So I think it just makes sense that they would move on from them. And, you know, we faced a similar situation in Memphis with Zach Randolph and Tony Allen, where they were just at a point where it didn't totally make sense for us to go all in to bring them back because we were going to have to turn around that boat. And I think they're kind of at that similar point with Kyle Lowry.
Well, also interesting, Masai's comments this morning. I don't know if people saw those yet, but he's basically saying he's not sure if he's going to come back and he wanted to kind of be a free agent, and that whether he comes back is going to be dependent upon whether basically like Toronto's ownership like makes a change. He said things along the line. I got to listen to this whole presser. I just saw some Twitter clips of it, but that Toronto needs to like advocate more for itself in the league hierarchy. I guess he wants like the ownership overall to be more involved potentially. So that I understand, Caleb, why you're so confused with the situation in Toronto, because I am too. I have no idea what's going on there with Lowry and why they didn't trade him and all that, right? I mean, what are people up there saying? Are they just totally befuddled as well?
Yeah, pretty much the same process of thought. Like, everyone thought he was going to be traded, and if he didn't get traded, are they going to bring him back? Like, that's the whole thing. Like, why bring him back? Like, why not deal him if you're not going to bring him back just to lose him for nothing? That's our whole thought process up here.
Yeah. There's the report of maybe that Philly is going to try and get involved with him again with in sign and trade talks, but presumably he won't get as much in a sign and trade as he would have gotten before.
So, no.
And then just the fact that, like, they keep him around and then they just completely shut him down for the rest of the year as well, which, I mean,
exactly. That's the other.
Makes sense. You know, they got the 7th seed in the lottery. That's pretty good.
It was well-executed mini tank at the end there by the Raptors. I mean, you can't dispute that.
Yeah, it was more like an armored personnel carrier, not necessarily like a full main battle tank.
Light infantry.
I read a lot of Tom Clancy books as a child. I'm sorry. Okay, let's get a couple more in here. Thanks for that one. Let's go to
thank you.
Let's get to Chet. How you doing, Chet?
Good. How you guys doing? A long time listener, first time getting in here. I wanted to ask, I'm a Laker fan, and obviously the playoffs is going to be dependent on, you know, LeBron and AD's health and whatnot, but I'm more focused on the offseason. With Caruso, THT, and Schroeder all up for, you know, we're going to have to re-sign one, two, or three of them. I mean, THT, Caruso, they could get paid a lot depending on by what team they could get fall in love with. Like, what kind of offers should we be matching, and how should we be handling that situation?
Well, I mean, you're in it. You have LeBron James and Anthony Davis in their prime right now. So the answer is you spend the money right now. I mean, you're the Lakers too. You can't plead poverty, right? So to me, you're matching almost anything reasonable on Schroeder and Caruso, because I think those are core guys for you. You might sort of secretly be hoping that Montrezl Harrell opts out of his deal. Horton Tucker, I think, is an interesting one. I think somebody's going to drop a big sheet on him and see if the Lakers flinch because of the luxury tax implications. But I would try to keep him if I was the Lakers too, just because they're protected a little bit the first 2 years of that Arenas rule. Like, no matter, even if he gets the Tyler Johnson special, it's only the mid-level those first 2 years. And those are the 2 years where LeBron is on this huge number. So I actually think, like, you know, you got to go ahead and shoot money out of the fire hose a little bit when you're at this point in the evolution of a franchise, because you're just not going to keep getting these chances over and over again, even as the Lakers, right? Like, you still only get so many chances with players like this in their prime.
Right. That's for sure true. I mean, here's the only thing I'm like thinking of is the Schroeder and THT is kind of a similar skill set, and it's a little bit of a redundancy. And we've all the Laker fans, Laker Twitter, we're all up in arms that we didn't go after like a bigger wing type that could mesh with LeBron and AD, more like a bigger wing that could, you know, kind of hang with Paul George and Kawhi.
Yeah, maybe
or whatever.
Like, a,
and
then like a Danny Green, that type of player. No, I'm just no. I mean, okay. Danny.
First of all, it's not our fault. It's not our fault that every time someone comes to the Lakers, they forget how to shoot. Okay, that is not our fault.
Yeah, he shot it well enough last year, but yeah. I mean, I think they did need to get one more playmaker. I don't know if Schroeder would have been the guy that I would have targeted there. And man, I mean, that's we got asked.
I was thinking more midseason.
Oh yeah,
when they went with Drummond.
Yeah, Lowry. I mean, I think that was an interesting one too. If it was really just Talen Horton-Tucker and not also including a first round pick, like Horton-Tucker and Schroeder for Lowry, if that was the trade, maybe
I think KCP might have been in that too.
Yeah, I mean, KCP. Then it gets a little tough. Maybe they could have gotten somebody more on the buyout market, because yeah, I don't think they could have gotten there unless they had also included KCP in terms of salary matching. In any event, yeah, it's gonna be fascinating in their offseason. And we didn't mention him, but Schroeder clearly is another one of these veterans who's just has a lot on the line here. If the Lakers go out early, do they really want to pay him all this money? Probably not. You know, they might just try to go in another direction, and he's also not gonna have much of a market elsewhere. If the Lakers make a good run or win the championship, then yeah, he'll probably get his $25 million.
All right, thanks guys. One more thing, is there a chance that we could do any sort of sign and trade with THT, or does that not work money wise?
Yeah, you could sign and trade him out. The problem is the base year rule, like you're just not getting, you're only going to get like a $5 million exception out of it. So if you're getting draft equity out of it, then maybe that's something if you feel like it's going to be a gross offer that you don't want to match.
Yeah.
Right. All right. Thanks, guys.
Yeah. And to be clear, what John's talking about is if you do a sign and trade, the outgoing salary doesn't count for that much when the guy wasn't making very much to begin with, which obviously Horton Tucker was on a minimum. Okay. We've got time here. Let's see. Let me get in here. Let's do one more let's get Brian in here. Brian, how are you?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Pretty well. What's up?
Okay, quickly, so I know everyone's talking about the play-in and the first round, but I want to think about some future casting here. So the one second round playoff matchup that everyone is penciling in right now is Jazz versus Clippers. Given that, I'm curious for your perspective on that matchup. And my thought really quickly is that it's a very, very bad matchup for the Jazz for a couple of reasons. First, the Clippers have two all-NBA, you know, apex predator type wings. And the Jazz have basically a single above average, capably sized wing defender in Royce O'Neal. And secondly, you know, the Jazz's entire structure, as John has talked about so eloquently, is built around Rudy Gobert and that drop coverage that is focused on protecting the rim. And that doesn't really matter against the Clippers because they take so few shots at the rim, and they can punish a drop defense with those five out lineups featuring guys like Marcus Morris and Serge Ibaka. And then on the other side of the ball, the Clippers can throw Beverly, George, and Rondo at Mitchell. And they are one of the best teams in the league set up to switch everything and remain competitive against, you know, that Mitchell-Gobert or that Ingles-Gobert pick and roll. So, and I also think people are underplaying a little bit how difficult the Jazz's path to an NBA championship is. I mean, after the first round, which should be easy, it's potentially Clippers, Lakers, and then either Nets, Bucks, or Sixers. So I'm just curious for your general take on people really not talking about how the one seed in the West really has an unfavorable series of matchups ahead of it.
Yeah, they got to be so pissed the Clippers tanked that game, because by all rights, they should be playing Denver again, or Denver-Dallas winner in the second round, right? Which I think they'd feel more comfortable with. And instead, It's the Clippers, and the Clippers, as you point out, I mean, with their jump shooting and whatnot. Now, I will say, I mean, the Jazz aren't just a drop coverage. Like, Gobert can switch. He's actually pretty good at it. But the problem is then you move the ball, and then you have another player with potentially a mismatch against, you know, Conley or Mitchell or whatever, and Gobert's away from the rim, and there's nobody else. So that creates some issues. And I do think the Clippers, they have the switchability aspect. They don't have great rim protection. And, you know, the Jazz are able to hurt you inside, even if it's not necessarily Gobert. Like, Bogdanovich is a good post player. Like, if you just switch and, you know, end up with a small on him, like, he's going to mash that guy. You know, Ingles is big. Like, he can do some stuff against small guards because he's just kind of, you know, Heisman trophying them a little bit on his drive. So I still think there's some advantages there for them if the Clippers are caught with the right lineup. It's an uncomfortable matchup for Utah. It's not a, like, for a 1-4 matchup, it feels more like a 50-50 series to me than your typical 1-4 where you're like, well, they're a, you know, 80-90% favorite. Like, you would not say that about this one at all. They did beat the Clippers twice this year, though, and the game they lost was pretty close.
Yeah. I mean, I thought the one where the Clippers did win was, you know, just a perfect
point
for why they would not.
Yeah, win. They won in the exact way you thought they would win against the Jazz, right? Yeah. Like, it was absolutely perfect. Yeah.
Yeah, and going with Morris at center, I mean, that spaces Gobert out, so it's just really difficult for him to provide more his usual help at the rim. So, I mean, I probably, knowing what we know now, I probably would pick that as Clippers in six, but I think the Jazz could still win this series, and particularly with home court. I think that's going to matter. The Jazz are going to have, you know, like 10,000, 12,000 fans in there with the number one seed. I mean, I expect them to, that to be a big deal, that Jazz home court. All right, well, this was a lot of fun. Thanks to everyone who submitted a speaker request. Sorry that we can't get to everyone, but we'll be back to talk next week, same time, 2 Eastern, 11 Pacific. And John, what did you write about for The Athletic this week before we go?
Well, I wrote about my award picks, and I had my play-in picks too, actually. But as we talked about earlier in the show, I picked all my awards for the season. And then coming tomorrow, I do have my first round playoff picks will be out.
Yeah, and Danny and I are doing something really fun now. We're going to be casting games on this app called Hot Mic, where basically you can just download the app and it will sync up our commentary to your TV automatically. And then you can ask us questions. You can even jump in, similar style to what they do on Locker Room here, to ask us questions during the course of the game. So the first one we're doing is going to be tonight, actually, for Warriors and Lakers. And then we'll be doing that throughout, probably about 3 times a week throughout the postseason. So please check that out. Join us, watch the game. We'll do live commentary. If you haven't had a chance to join us on through the NBA on League Pass, we're now doing this Hot Mic app since all these games are on national TV, obviously. So we will talk to y'all next time. Till then.